This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello and Happy New Year and welcome to 2024. And what a way to start the new year with this very special Woman's Hour programme. Well, today we've decided to make it all about negotiation and women's roles in that. It will hopefully help and inform our new year, because to negotiate is to choose the path of communication, not violence or war, and to reach an agreement and get what you want. That's from an article in Psychology Today. And this morning we're going to be looking at all types of negotiation, from your own kitchen to global agreements and women's roles within them. We're going to be hearing from two women who were actually seated around the table at some of last year's most world-changing negotiations. Nomi Bar-Yakov, who negotiates all over the world, trying to mediate international conflicts, and Rachel Kite, who has been involved in negotiations to tackle climate change for years. And we'll take a look back at women's roles in negotiations of the past. Did you know, for example, that wives and mistresses were influential in negotiations to end one of Europe's biggest wars? Well, Professor Margaret Macmillan will tell us more about that. Plus, we'll look at negotiation in our own everyday lives, from negotiating with five-year-olds to negotiating with friends. With Instagram mum legend Jane Dowden, and have a look into our brains to see what goes on emotionally with psychologist Catherine Hallisey. Now, this programme has been pre-recorded, so we won't be able to read out any of your comments you send us during the programme. But we always love to hear from you. So if you want to add anything, perhaps your own experiences in negotiation or some tips you'd like to share, or even your thoughts on some of the stories you've heard this morning, you can get in touch in the usual way. On social media, we're at BBC Woman's Hour, and you can email us through our website. And throughout the programme today, I'm delighted to say that I'll have a real expert alongside me. Nikki Perfect has spent most of her life negotiating, not just with friends and family like we all do, but in her career working with the New Scotland Yard Crisis Negotiation Unit. She's now retired, but is still working to help people learn how to communicate and negotiate through workshops. Nikki, welcome to this special episode of Woman's Hour. It's so good to have you next to me, because your career has had some surmountable moments. And for those listeners who haven't heard from you before, can you just take us through exactly what your job as a negotiator entails?
Yeah, thank you so much, Hayley. It's so lovely to be here. I always feel when people introduce me as Nikki Perfect that I do have to explain Perfect really is my surname.
It's not something I'm sure you're perfect in other ways as well.
So, I was privileged and honoured. It was a real joy to be part of the Hostage and Crisis Negotiation Unit at New Scotland Yard. I became a negotiator after I had 20 years' service as a police officer in the Met in London. And I only became a negotiator because one of my mentors said to me, "Hey, Nick, have you ever thought about becoming a negotiator?" And that's why when I reflect on conversations and communication and how powerful it is, it's those conversations that are life-changing conversations. So for me, communication is a superpower. And I'll talk about that as the show goes on, about why I believe that to be true. So, yeah, I've had an amazing career, served all over London, ended up the last 6 years as the UK Director of Hostage and Crisis Negotiation. So responsible for all those people becoming a negotiator in the UK, and also had the privilege of working internationally on behalf of Her Majesty's Government, both training and with British citizens that had been caught up in incidents or kidnapped as well. So I've had a real varied life, but it's been an honour.
You must definitely have some stories, because I know you've written a book, Crisis, True Stories of My Life as a Hostage Negotiator, and in which you tell the story of some of the negotiations you were part of, and some of them make really tough reading, I must say. But is there one in particular that stands out in your memory?
Yeah, I think it's always the first one that stands out in most people's memory, and that was because that changed my whole view on how we talk to people and how I spoke to people. I've got to be honest with you, before I went on my negotiation course, I thought I was quite a good communicator. And I was like, yeah, this is okay. This course will be all right. It was a very intensive 2-week course where they kind of look at everything you say and do and why you say and do it.
Really? Wow.
And I had one of those epiphany moments that people might be able to relate to whilst I was there. And I was like, wow, this has just changed my whole viewpoint. So I really want to be a negotiator now for the rest of my policing career, but probably for the rest of my life. And I remember doing that first negotiation, you know, when you get a set of new skills and you're like, I can't wait to use these, can't wait to save the world. That was literally how I was thinking, great, I'm a negotiator now. That's amazing. I can save the world, change everything. And I remember I wasn't even on call. So the most negotiators in the UK in police, they do it on top of their day job. So they're really dedicated to the role of being a negotiator. So they do their day job, then they put themselves on call and they sacrifice family time. There'll be people, you know, who've just spent Christmas on call negotiating with people. Mm. And there'll be people today that are probably waiting for a phone call. They'll have their phone calls, their phones next to them as we go into the new year. And so my first negotiation, I wasn't on call. I got a phone call from somebody who was who taught me how to be a negotiator. So when I picked up my phone and saw his name on the phone, I was super excited. I was like, wow, this is amazing. I know what this is. And he said, Nick, I'm really sorry, you're not on call, but would you mind going to this negotiation? And I said, no, of course not. No problem at all. What's happening? So he says to me, there's a young lad, he's been released from prison for grievous bodily harm. He's gone round to see his ex-partner. His ex-partner and him have got a child. He's never seen the child. They've had an emotional discussion. She's alleging that she has been assaulted, but he's taken the child without her permission. It's been a car chase around London and now they're surrounded. So I was like, yeah, of course I can go to that.
Wow.
He said, can you just get the child out safely and then get him out safely? And I'm like, yes, definitely. So I'm waiting for a fast car, which is a car with blue lights and two tones to take me to the call. And I've got this running through my head. Heroin negotiator arrives on scene, which is me, obviously, with my newfound skills. And she starts talking to him and he starts talking to her. They listen to each other. He gets out the car, shakes her by the hand, hands her the child, and everything is fine.
The day is saved.
The day is saved, yes. 8 hours later, and he said two things to me. One I'm not going to repeat on radio, and the other one was, you don't understand.
Wow.
And that was really powerful for me, because I reflected on that all of the time afterwards, and I was like, maybe I'm not going to be a very good negotiator. Maybe these new skills are not going to be for me. Maybe this is not the path. And I really questioned myself. And then later, as I did lots more research on psychology and human behaviour and watched other negotiators, I was so lucky to be surrounded by amazing mentors in the negotiation world. I realised that whole conversation was about me and what I wanted and what I believed was going to happen, that I was going to turn up. And I'd never stopped and gone, what does the world look like from his perspective? Doesn't see this heroin negotiator walking towards him. He sees a white, middle-aged, middle-class woman and probably thinks, well, what on earth have we got in common?
Mm.
And he'd have been right, because I wasn't thinking about what it would be like to have just come out of prison, to have not seen your child. And he probably saw me as somebody who was going to take his child away and send him back to a place he didn't want to go to.
So there's lots of emotions involved in there. There's fear on his part.
Yep.
There's sort of adrenaline on both sides. And that must have taught you a lot in that first instance. It was a learning curve, really. But how did it end? And was the child okay?
So the good news is the child was okay. He ended up being tasered, which was not how I wanted it to end. Again, all about me and what I want. And yeah, sadly, you know, he ended up going back to prison. And yeah, it taught me a lot. That negotiation really taught me a lot about how looking at the world from somebody else's perspective is key. In a negotiation, so that you can collaborate and work together.
And it taught you a lot, and you went on to achieve so much more. So what do you think is the most valuable lesson you learned as a negotiator across the whole of your career?
Across the whole of my career, I would say that I have always underestimated the power of listening, and I didn't really know how to listen. And that most of us listen from a perspective of, oh, I can't wait for my say in the conversation. I'd just like to give my point of view, because we do have really strong points of views and opinions, and there's nothing wrong with it. It's just recognising that we don't always need to give our opinion, and that sometimes people don't want to hear our opinion. And actually, when we listen from a different perspective, from an active listening, emotional, intuitive, I want to understand where you're coming from perspective, that helps that other person to feel valued and validated. And when people feel valued and validated and they have a place and a space in the world, it enables you to build relationships really quickly, even in the most challenging of circumstances.
And you're right to say it's not about you, but in a way, you've been through and seen some really traumatic things and situations. So in that sense, it does have an effect on you. How do you protect yourself and your mental health in those negotiating situations?
I reflect on this all the time because I'm, even now I've been out of police negotiation for 5 years, there's still those times when you stop and something will happen. So, for example, I find it really challenging to watch violence on TV. If there's a loud noise, I overreact. I know I do. So I'm fully aware of those things that I do. I have always been into fitness and health. I'm pretty sure that helped me a lot throughout my policing career in general. When you see trauma after trauma after trauma, it has an impact, and anybody in the emergency services will be able to relate to that. And I think also there was a separation, always a clear line for me that, and I call it the darkness in the book, that the darkness didn't step over the doorstep with me into my house. So I, at the time, I was living with my partner and my six-year-old stepdaughter, and I never wanted her especially to be affected by that in any way, shape or form. And also you have a strong support network from other people that you work with, and they're the people that understand and can relate to what you're going through.
Well, we're going to come on to those negotiations at family times as well later in the programme. So please stay with us, Nikki. It's lovely to have you on
Thank
the show
you.
And you're going to be with us throughout the programme. So I'm sure we'll come back to your story, but also your advice and handy tips a little bit later on. One listener who's called Itinerant Wanderer on Instagram has messaged to say a negotiation is not just a single conversation. You need to understand what's required, find evidence and then present it. So thank you so much for that. But before we hear from the first of our women involved in negotiations, which alter the course of the world, I want to have a little look back a bit further than that, because as we all know, historically, women have been barely in the background of some major events, which have mostly involved male leaders across the world. But does this translate to negotiations as well? Joining me now is historian Margaret McMillan, Emeritus Professor of History at the University of Toronto and an Emeritus Professor of International History at Oxford University. Margaret, thank you so much for coming on the programme.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Good morning. I want to start, if I may, with the Congress of Vienna at the end of the Napoleonic Wars, because this was in the early 1800s. And what was the aim of these negotiations? Because there's some quite interesting stories in the background there, isn't there?
Well, the aim was to settle a war that had gone on, which had killed people all over Europe, which had disrupted Europe for over 20 years. France had dominated much of the continent, and eventually a coalition was formed against it and defeated Napoleon. And what happened then? There was a Congress in Vienna of the powers that were in the coalition. They included Britain, of course, Russia, Prussia. And curiously enough, the Congress itself included France, because Napoleon had been deposed. And so a new French government had been formed, and it was there. And also Austria, the great empire in the middle of Europe. And what they were trying to do is, in a sense, put the pieces back together again, create a lasting system that would create peace, sort out what were a great many outstanding issues. They had to sort out borders. They had to decide who got which throne and so on. So it was quite an event. I mean, it lasted for well over a year.
And did women have any role in that? Because that's definitely not common knowledge.
No. Well, women had no official role, because in those days they mostly didn't, unless they inherited a throne or unless they somehow managed to get into a position of power. But they played a hugely important part. And I think they played a part in other negotiations before, because they acted. I was listening with such interest to what Nikki was saying about communication.
Yeah.
And these women acted to communicate between the different statesmen, and they were often trusted. I mean, Metternich, the Austrian chancellor, who was probably the cleverest man there and really helped to pull the pieces together and build a lasting peace, had a couple of women he trusted completely. He talked to them. He got their advice. He relied on them. And the women had great parties. I mean, you know, you may think a party isn't important, but in fact, it was a way where people got together. And I think in any negotiation, but, you know, your experts will know better than me, in any negotiation, personal contact matters. You have to learn to trust other people. You have to learn at least to know what they're thinking.
Yeah.
And the women played a very important part in this.
And that's very clever. I think we call them networking events nowadays. But actually, a party is a great way sometimes to get allies on side, isn't it? And so there were obviously women working behind the scenes then. And then by the time we get to the end of the First World War, which is 100 years later, women very much take a back seat for the most part, or at least that's what we think. Is that the case?
That is indeed the case. And it's curious, isn't it? Because we think, you know, the further back you go in history, the less influence women have. But what happened in the 19th century was that a lot of things got professionalized. People began to have to do exams to get into foreign offices, and women could not apply. And so women were not there. There's a big conference again at the end of the First World War, which is in fact modeled on the Congress of Vienna 100 years before. And women were there, but only as typists, secretaries, sometimes drivers. They were there as support. Mm-hmm. And so there were almost no women who actually played any part at the peace conference itself. And you didn't have the same sort of parties and the same sort of networking that you got at the Congress of Vienna.
And do you think that was detrimental?
I think it was detrimental because I think, I mean, who knows whether it's evolution or whether it's cultural, but I think women have a great capacity to notice. They have an empathy often, I think, more than men do in some cases. And I think they can be very good at sort of understanding other characters and other people and trying to understand them and work with them. And so, yes, I think it was detrimental. It meant that, you know, they were depriving themselves of the talents of half the human race.
I think another thing I want to get into is women involved in negotiations, not as the influencers, but as the thing being negotiated over. Because that's happening a lot, isn't it?
Yes, and it's always happened. And in the past, women were often taken hostage. They were prizes. But what also happened is if two parties, say two states, which had been at war, came together and decided to make peace, they often exchanged women as a sort of pledge that they would be friends. And so, you know, poor little 15-year-old princesses would be shipped off to marry someone they'd never met before and told they were there to do their best for their family and who'd sent them.
And I suppose as a fight back, have there been occasions in history where women have made real problems for negotiators, like perhaps even ruined them or definitely got in the way?
Oh, I think so. I mean, women have often acquired power. I mean, just because they don't have formal power doesn't mean they can't have a great deal of power. And you get women, I mean, Catherine the Great of Russia was a poor little German princess. Again, she was very young, set off to marry this, I think, probably crazy Russian czar. I mean, he was dreadful. And somehow he got killed. And I think she had something to do with it. And she then became the regent for her little son. And in fact, she became the empress of Russia for a very long time, you know, throughout the 18th century and into the beginning of the 19th century. And she was very powerful indeed. And she did this because she was ruthless. She picked her favorites. She picked her sides. And so she maneuvered through a very dangerous and difficult world to become a very powerful person. And though, yes, women could often get positions of power, and when they wanted, they could certainly disrupt negotiations.
But bringing us back to modern times, so in the last few decades, there have obviously been some incredibly influential women playing a big part in negotiations. Which ones stand out for you? What are the most important there?
I think Madeleine Albright, US Secretary of State, who was very effective at dealing with other people. Angela Merkel, I think, someone who was respected by the people she had to deal with. She managed to win over most people, not always, but she famously managed to deal with Vladimir Putin, which not many people can do. Margaret Thatcher, I mean, you know, the picture of Margaret Thatcher is of her swinging her handbag and stamping her feet and being rude to people in the European Union. In fact, I think she was a very successful negotiator and she got more out of the European Union than many of her successors ever did.
So is there anything then that connects these women across history? Are there any character traits or anything you think they shared that made them so successful that we can perhaps learn from?
Difficult to say, because some of them were absolutely ruthless. Some of them were not. Some of them were willing to compromise. Again, I think I'd go back to what Nikki was saying, that perhaps what marked them out is they had the capacity to be observant, to notice the people they were dealing with. They understood people. They understood psychology. They had the capacity to play on people and, when necessary, get really tough with them. And you think of your own Queen Elizabeth I, and she was someone who could maneuver. Well, she survived to begin with through a very, very difficult childhood. And she could maneuver very carefully through the court. She managed to become queen. She picked very good advisors. She maneuvered through European politics. You know, so I think, yes, I think you have a great many examples of women who I think did so partly because they were prepared to observe and prepared to figure out who it was they were dealing with.
Professor Margaret McMillan, thank you so much for coming on the show. You've given us so much to think about. Now it's time to meet the first of our guests this morning, who has been part of negotiations that have changed the course of the world, this time in terms of international conflict. Nomi Bar-Yakov is an associate fellow for the Chatham House International Security Programme. She served as a legal advisor for the UN in countries around the world. Well, I spoke to Nomi a little earlier and she told me about what her role entails.
So I convene back-channel negotiations. Back-channel negotiations are very important, a very important part of conflict resolution. I mean, reaching ceasefires, reaching agreements on any disputes between states or between states and non-state actors. There's a certain level of mediation and negotiation that governments can do. That in our vocabulary is track one negotiations, but many states don't have diplomatic relations with the either entities or not meaning armed non-state actors or other states. So they need people like me to try to work out how to end conflicts or prevent conflicts or anything to try to help to get to peace, basically.
So your role is incredibly pivotal, and that back channel way of working you talk about, what exactly happens? So when you walk in the room or when you speak to somebody, what happens? What is it you're capable of doing?
So first of all, I'm not the only person who convenes back channel negotiations. So it's not just about me. There are plenty of wonderful women and men who convene or participate in back channel negotiations. I also participate. I don't always. I'm not always the organizer. And it's been proven to be extremely effective in reaching agreements on a huge variety of issues. For example, the Israeli-Palestinian Oslo Accords, the 1993 recognition of Israel by the PLO, the Palestinian Liberation Organization, and of an Israel of the PLO, which until that moment in September 93 was considered a terrorist organization. The entire negotiation leading up to that pivotal moment was done in back channel negotiations in Oslo. That's why they're known as the Oslo Accords. So it was basically Norwegians who convened, invited the Israelis and the Palestinians. So that's a public example that I did not participate in. I wasn't not of that generation, but
a massive movement in time, which is down to that group of people. Can you give us an example of a negotiation that you've been involved in?
I do a lot of work in the Middle East. I do a lot of back channel work with various countries, including Palestine and Israel, including Iran. Not at the moment, though, but for many, many years. Including other states in the region, but I don't only do exclusively Middle East. I'm sort of I think that the skills necessary for international mediation are transformable to any conflict. But of course, knowing the history of a conflict, knowing the languages, knowing the culture is extremely important. So Middle East is my main area of expertise.
Talk me through those skills, because I know you speak six languages and you have to be aware of many, many cultural differences. What skills do you use to help create that negotiation?
I think culture is very important, understanding the culture and the narrative, the fact that conflicts are... There won't be a conflict if the narrative was the same for both parties or for all parties. So everyone has their truth and they believe that that is the only way to look at a conflict is through their lens. So putting them in the shoes or in the boots of the other and trying to expose them, open them up to showing that there actually is a flip side to the coin and what was viewed as a certain event in history and time, which very significant for you, was actually an absolute disaster for the other side. So I think one needs patience, empathy. Studying the conflict is very important. I mean, preparation is I would rate that maybe the highest skill. It's just being able to learn and to get to put in the time before a negotiation or mediation starts, doing all the background work, hearing and listening, which I always say are two different skills.
I've heard that before, but how so in your point of view?
Well, you hear what a party says and then you tune in and you listen and then you go back and you hear and you sort of, there's so much preconditioning. We say, oh, we've heard that before. Oh, it's that mantra. But actually trying to deconstruct and give it the space, because clearly for a party that uses a certain mantra, it has a different meaning to the party that is listening or hearing on the other side.
It's so interesting to talk to you because I suppose we're talking about business and professionalism, but from such a, you talk about empathy, patience, listening. There must be a lot of emotion involved in what you do. Is that difficult to divide the two between creating something and receiving a result, you know, to take that away from the emotion involved in that process?
Well, I think the emotion is important, actually. I don't think you want to take the emotion away. Mm. I think there's a lot of emotion, an awful lot of emotion. I have goosebumps just speaking to you now. And it's because one has to really tune in. So you're sort of brought up, for example, in a certain place, being told, oh, this party or this country is absolute evil. And then you listen to them and you kind of work out that they're not actually evil. And what does evil mean? And how to... So the emotion is really important to be able to tune in. You don't need to agree, but you need to absolutely put yourself in that body. Heart, mind, heart, soul. And I always think we speak with different frequencies. We have a... I've always been told I'm very cerebral. So, you know, with our brains, but also to tune into our heart frequency. And it's well known that the heart radiates an awful lot of energy. I think it also has a different intelligence. So just being able to switch from the mind to the heart is extremely important. And as I said, you don't need to agree, but you just need to listen and hear and appreciate that there's an awful lot that you don't know. And I think humbleness is very important, coming into a mediation without any preconceived ideas, being open to different scenarios and trying and going through the rough and smooth, because there's an awful lot of emotion. There's a lot of frustration. You come up with an idea. You think, oh, brilliant, excellent, that's going to work. And then it doesn't necessarily, or part of it does. So being flexible is very important. Being optimistic is absolute key, because there's no point in trying to mediate seemingly intractable conflicts if you don't really believe that there is a way forward. And being open to different solutions, ones that haven't been discussed and chewed 100 million times before.
Just talking to you, I'm aware that your CV must be amazing, but also must be quite different from other people's that perhaps list qualifications and skills, whereas a lot of your skills are about personality traits and talents and things that define you. And I know that you want to inspire more young women to go into leadership and negotiation as well. Why is that important to you? And do you think it's possible to get the new people coming forward? Or is it quite a difficult job that's quite specific?
No, I think that I came in from human rights. I'm a human rights lawyer. You know, all my degrees are in law. Mm. It sounds terribly boring. When I was interviewed for my first degree in law at university, and I was asked, oh, would you consider, they said, what would you like to do? And I said, my interviewer said, oh, I would like to do international negotiations and peace negotiations and advise governments on how to get to peace. And I feel that a law degree would be a useful tool in this. And they said, oh, what about tax law and commercial law? Would you consider doing that? And I sort of thought, oh, I have no idea. No, I've never done anything about tax law and anything about commercial law. Doesn't interest me at all. And I thought it'd be a terrible answer to say absolutely not. So I said, well, I'm open to studying it. And if I develop a passion for it, then I will pursue it. And if not, then I will just have an additional qualification, but I will pursue my passions. I think pursuing one's passion is very important. I really do. I think that would be my greatest tip for the young ladies that I'm going to speak to in a school on International Human Rights Day. It's very important to inspire young people, to explain to them. I think everyone has what it takes to get to peace. And I think every single one of us and every single listener has a role to play. I think if you get to inner peace and you're at peace with yourself, at harmony with yourself, it puts you in a much better position to, if everybody had achieved internal peace, there would also be peace in the world.
I think that's a great tip and something we're probably all going to strive for this year. I know that you're one of very few women at the higher levels of these negotiations. Do you think you're treated differently because of that?
I think I'm treated differently in the sense that I walk into a room and I make sure I'm dressed appropriately. I think the energy is different, maybe. And it's like, oh, Nomi's here. So it's quite nice to see a woman's face. and quite a smiley person. I'm not a stern, a harsh, nasty. You know, I don't have long nails and sort of horrendous nail varnish on it. I kind of quite a soft person inside, and I think that comes across. And I think softness actually is another quality, talking of qualities that one needs. I think softness is a really important quality in international negotiation and mediation, unlike commercial negotiation, where one party is trying to achieve more than the other. In international negotiations, you're trying to reach an agreement. So you're trying to reach a compromise that whereby both parties won't feel that they're hard done by, and they will feel this is a worthy compromise because ultimately they could live in peace and stability and equality and dignity.
Thank you so much, Nomi. That was Nomi Bar-Yakov from Chatham House speaking to me there. And still with me, of course, is Nikki Perfect, former negotiator with the New Scotland Yard Crisis Negotiation Unit. And Nikki, I could see you nodding along there to Nomi talking. And especially when she mentioned having the heart and mind playing a part in negotiations. You yourself have talked about these two brains, the emotional one and the logical one. Is that important in negotiating?
Yeah, definitely, because it's important to know where you're speaking from. So I was always taught, I was lucky enough to go over and work with the FBI, and one of their great negotiators, he always said to me, Nick, you know, you can't control what other people do, but the one thing you can control is how you respond to what people say to you and what you do. And I've always taken that on board. And so I think it's really important, especially in family negotiations, especially when there's so much emotion in a family negotiation, is that you recognise that when you do become emotional, when you do start talking from that emotional perspective, and actually embracing that emotion like we've just heard, is, yeah, because we are emotional beings and there is a lot of emotion involved in crisis negotiation, in international negotiations, in family negotiations. So for me, it's about just recognising the space that you're sitting in at the time. And do you need to just step out of that space for a bit before you come back?
Because talking about family, which I think could be one of the most trickiest situations going, you have a 16-year-old daughter. Mm-hmm. So what sort of negotiations do you go through with her?
So thankfully, I have a pretty good 16-year-old daughter. and so she's a stepdaughter. And I'll always remember the first time I met her. She was six. I was in my early 40s, and of course I thought I knew everything about children because I was a great parent until I had a child in my life, I always say. And then I remember going round there, and they were having their house renovated at the time, and I thought, I know that the really nice thing to do would be to take round a meal for them both, and that will show to Meg that I am a trustworthy, decent adult, and she'll accept me straight away. Of course, that didn't happen. So I take in a chicken casserole, I put it on the side in the kitchen. She walks in and she's like, what is that? And I'm like, that's chicken casserole. And she went, I don't like chicken casserole, and walked straight out.
Oh, my goodness.
And I was like, I'm going to have to work on this step-parenting thing. An assumption on my part that I would gain trust by just a chicken casserole. And of course, it doesn't work like that. Trust is super important. We heard that earlier, that you've got to get to a level of trust with somebody before they will be willing to collaborate or even listen to what you've got to say.
Yeah. I mean, she sounds like quite a few six-year-olds I know, so don't feel bad for that half. But what are your top tips for us negotiating with family or with friends?
Yeah, so we'll go back to that perspective. So we have our own belief system, our own truth, as we've just heard. And sometimes we live into that truth and other people have a different perspective and a different truth. And sometimes when people challenge our perspective, it feels like they're challenging us personally. And because of that, we can hit back with like a confrontation and an emotional response. Now, we know that the emotional response generally lasts about 90 seconds. There's a great book called My Stroke of Insight by Dr. Bolt Taylor, and she talks about how she was a brain specialist. She had a stroke and she started observing everything that was going on around her. And she noticed that if you don't say anything, if you don't respond within 90 seconds, actually that emotional sort of adrenaline that goes through the body where you just want to kick back, it stops, it eases down. Now, you can keep it in play by starting to think about it. And so you can, if you think about a difficult conversation you've ever had, you replay it, don't you? Replay it over and over again. And the more you think about it, the more wound up you get about it, and maybe the more angry or frustrated or whatever it might be. So just remember that sometimes if you can just press the big pause button for 90 seconds and let that go before you respond, you might avoid a conflict conversation.
That's a very good tip. It's so hard in the moment, though, isn't
really
it? But it's
hard.
Definitely something we can try, maybe one of our New Year's resolutions. Well, thank you for those tips, Nikki. And of course, We probably all negotiate more day to day than we might realise. If you have kids, especially, negotiating with small ones to put their shoes on, or maybe negotiating a curfew with older ones. But especially around the holidays, there's lots of negotiations, maybe around where to spend Christmas or who goes to where. Or for many of you, there'll be in-laws to negotiate with, and parents and external family. Well, joining me now are Jane Dowden, who you might know better as Mum and a Mike on Instagram and TikTok. She shares her parenting highs and lows in hilarious fashion. Also, Catherine Hallisey, a clinical psychologist, to help us look a bit further into our brains when we're negotiating. Well, I want to get on to children now and those negotiations, and we'll do that in just a moment. But first, Catherine, you work especially with children and parents. So how much of your work is about negotiating?
I think it's fair to say that 99% of my work is about negotiation.
Right.
I think any human who is interacting with any other person, we're negotiating all day long. There may be small negotiations right up to the bigger, more high intensity conflict points. And so I just listened with such fascination to the previous speakers, because everything that was said actually applies to family negotiations as well. Even from the point of view of what Nikki was just saying there about emotions. So emotions are simply energy in motion. So if we can allow that wave of emotion to just pass for the 90 seconds, we can then come to a much steadier place in our responses rather than having a big emotional reaction.
So what actually is going on in our head psychologically when we are negotiating? Because it seems there's a lot of emotion involved, but there must be other things at play as well.
There are so many emotions involved, you know, so you might, anger might be the emotion that gets triggered, and anger then is likely to trigger the fight state, you know, the fight or flight. Or you may feel anxious, and that then will trigger the flight state, and you may want to avoid conflict at all costs. And we know that both of those emotions, when you bring them into the negotiation, they do lead to poorer outcomes. And the line here that I use is the power is in the pause. Mm. So if you can just pause, keep those words in your mouth and process the feeling that's going through you, and then you are able to respond much more thoughtfully. And even the concept that was spoken about earlier of listening to understand. So when I'm working with parents, and especially when they're talking about conflict with their teenagers, I say, you know, your job now for this week is listen, listen, listen. Mm. And when you feel like you've listened enough, listen some more.
And I know you've looked at this in particular, because there is a difference between men and women, isn't there? Women have different skills when it comes to negotiating. What do you see as them?
So in terms of men and women, I don't think these are inbuilt differences. I feel that these are gender biases that are conditioned from an early age. So women and girls tend to be conditioned to be nice and likable above all else. And boys and men are conditioned to be assertive/aggressive. And these gender biases, I feel that they restrict both of us. But typically assertiveness is interpreted as aggression in women. So women tend to really foster other skills, for example, empathy, perspective taking, staying at the table no matter what, seeing things through. And we know that persistence and patience are actually incredibly helpful in negotiation. So these are strengths that women, when you become aware of them, you can actually really enhance them. And also when you become aware of the ones that are less helpful in negotiation. So, for example, changing your behaviour so you're more likeable, or changing and having porous boundaries because you want to be nice. So when you are aware of that, you can actually become more aware of your own behaviours then that actually may be harming your negotiation or your conflict resolution skills.
But at the same time, I suppose it's something I massively relate to when you feel that, and I suppose all of us do, you know, you need to be nice in these situations. You need to, you know, it would be nice if people like you. But at the same time, does that hold you back from getting what you want or what you need?
If it becomes your primary driver, yes, it will definitely hold you back. I don't think there's anything wrong with likability. It's simply when that's your number one driver, when you are experiencing a threat to your identity, when you perceive that somebody doesn't like you, that is then when you can mold yourself in all sorts of different shapes, rather than being in the place that you want to be, setting those boundaries and enforcing those boundaries that you want to, so that you can create that life you want, so that you can create the family relationships that you want to have.
So it's a balance between the two. And talking of family relationships, Jane, I want to turn to you now, because you've got twin boys.
I do.
7 years old. Yeah. How much negotiating do you have to get into?
Oh, so much, so much. Just getting out the door. I put the shoes on, brush your teeth, eat your breakfast. Can we get in the car? And it's so interesting what you were saying about that 90 seconds. I've never thought of it like that. But I find that I've cried in the morning before going to the school run from pure frustration of just, oh my God, just get in the car. Why does this have to be so difficult? And actually, on the times when I've got the perspective to just bring it down a notch, chill, and just sort of, I guess, give them time to know that, you know, okay, you can have 2 more minutes, but then we really have to go, because if we're late, then that's going to put pressure on mummy, and I don't want to, you know, start my day. Do you want to start your day feeling like this? I don't want to. And actually, you think in the moment by stressing it, come on, go, out, now. It's not actually quicker.
Yeah.
Actually taking that time to have a breath. And I didn't really know that's what I was doing, but now I do. To kind of just go, okay, what's going on here? Calm down, everybody. This is what we need to do. Actually, when I do that, the morning's more pleasant.
And it's that understanding again, isn't it?
Yeah.
But rather, when we've heard from adults, they're trying to understand other people's perspective.
Yeah.
You're trying to let your children understand your perspective.
Yes.
You're trying to tell them, this is where we are. This is what's happening. This is why mummy's pulling her hair out.
Yeah. And I do. And I apologise to them when I do. And I go, look, I'm just stressed. And actually, this isn't all on you. I could have got myself more organised this morning. I feel like when you're more human with your children, it's a lot easier to negotiate. When you just, you know, don't have to be this figure up high that gets to set all the rules. I think if you just come down to their level and talk to them like a human, that sometimes gets much better results. And I feel better about myself as well.
So for the rest of us who are still crying on the bottom step, what are your top tips? Like, how do you negotiate with children?
Oh, pick your battles, I would say, is one of the most important things. Sometimes it's just not worth getting in the trenches for. We went to something a couple of weeks ago, and it was an event where my children would, you know, look smart in a suit, and they both wanted to wear their Crocs, you know, like sandals. And I really didn't want them to, and they really wanted to. And I actually just took a step back and I was like, actually, in the grand scheme of things, if they feel more comfortable going out today with their Crocs on, the issue is mine, it's not theirs. So that's one thing I'd say, just picking your battles, because what would that be worth them having a meltdown, leaving the house, feeling bad about themselves because they're not wearing their cool dinosaur, you know, shoes with holes in. So pick your battles. Kind of what I was talking about a minute ago, that trying to diffuse rather than escalate. So just, I try and come down to their level. And listen, I don't do this every time. You know, I definitely don't. If I'm a bit tired or I'm far from perfect. But if I want to make something happen, I find that just diffusing it, calming down, just, yeah, when I escalate, it's chaos and everyone has a rubbish morning or wherever we're going.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. I once had to take my children to work when I was interviewing a legal professional, and my daughter refused to take the Jasmine outfit off. So bearing midriff and all and sparkles around her belly, that's
her.
How she went.
Yeah. I know. And you know what? That's lovely, you know. Sometimes if someone was constantly telling me what I've got to wear, I'm like, no, I don't want to do. So why is there this kind of older figure that just gets to tell them what to do all the time? So yeah, I find that hard. I do have to sort of rein it in, but I try to let them be themselves.
We've had a brilliant tweet here from Angela Rawlins, or Batty Bird on Twitter. She sent this brilliant response to our question: do you negotiate with your children? She just replies in block capitals, no. So there you go. That's one perspective. Is there anything that's non-negotiable, do you think?
Yeah, there are some stuff. For some bizarre reason, my children are obsessed with horror films. I don't know why. And obviously, that's got to be age appropriate. So there's some, they keep going on about Alfred Hitchcock at the moment. I don't know why. They've heard something about Psycho and they want to watch it. Now, that's a non-negotiable. They're not allowed to watch Psycho at the moment. So they, you know, they keep coming to me like, so exactly how old have we got to be? Well, I need to check the rating, but we'll talk about it nearer the time. But I think with some stuff, you know, if a video game's too violent, that's a non-negotiable. I think they get a sense from me whether there's room for a conversation. And I think if there isn't, I think they can sense that and they'll probably drop it quite quickly because it's not up for discussion.
And what about with your husband? Do you work well as a negotiating team? Because it is quite common that one's softer than the other.
Yeah. Do you know what? We flip depending, okay. I think. We try to. I think on the important stuff, we try to back each other. But we're not perfect. Again, you know, who is? So there are times when I don't, and the kids get wind of that straight away, and they will play one off against the other. But I think on the important things we do, and we try and reinforce as well. So if something's been done that we don't deem acceptable, and my husband's talking to them about that, I will interject to sort of say, you know, we are united on this. That wasn't unacceptable. I don't appreciate you talking to others.
As a team, yeah, I can see that. And Catherine, just to bring you back in, what would your top tip be for our listeners when it comes to negotiating with a partner or a loved one or someone that is that close to you?
Well, I'm smiling listening to Jean because I have 5 children, including twin girls at the end.
Wow.
So I can really identify with everything you're saying. And I think to pick out some really important points in terms of choosing your battles, it's also important that as parents, when we get stressed, we can default to a no state all of the time. And that tends to come from stress, because the more stressed we feel, the more we want to control everything. And yet you've both spoken about times where you have relinquished control and it becomes a funny story. And that happens so often in our parenting lives if we allow it. So the more we can mind ourselves, I think that really enhances our ability to navigate potential conflicts. And then this empathy and perspective taking. So let's say with your partner, being able to put yourself in their shoes.
And can that be said the same for in-laws or grandparents? Because that can be another level of difficulty, couldn't it?
Oh, definitely. You know, and I have a really good process for navigating conflict with your in-laws. And it's simply that the person who has the primary relationship is in charge of negotiating boundaries. That person who has the primary relationship, they have to be the one, because of course their relationship is stronger than, like, let's say it's you with your in-laws. If you're coming in and setting boundaries, there's huge potential for divided loyalties. And I think you can easily step on landmines, whereas if your partner steps on that same landmine, they have a much stronger buffer in their relationship to be able to repair that and go on and make peace.
Yeah, that makes complete sense. Thank you, Catherine. Thank you, Jane. I have been noting down everything you've said. So next week in our house, there's going to be peace, harmony, and everyone's going to have their shoes on and at school at exactly the right time. So psychologist Catherine Hallisey and mum and a mic, Jane Dowden, thank you both for coming on the programme this morning. Now, if you cast your mind back, not too far, but to the end of last year, it was COP28, the biggest coming together of representatives and leaders from all over the world. And it's all about negotiating how we can come together to tackle climate change. So now we come to the second of our guests, who was involved in hugely influential negotiations there. Rachel Kite has been to several COP negotiations and was the former UN General Secretary's Special Representative for Sustainable Energy for All. Rachel, welcome back from Dubai. So first of all, how many COPs have you actually been to?
Too many.
Too many to count. So you have been in the room where these negotiations have been happening. Negotiations that hopefully end in nations across the world agreeing to tackle climate change together. But I'm sure it can't be smooth running. What is that like?
Yeah, so I think it's important to think of it as concentric circles. So in the very inner circle, you've got people representing governments. So they're civil servants, and then ministers come in when it comes down to the final wire. And then you've got around them, you've got a second circle of people. Often that's where I would be. So providing technical expertise, organizations that would have to implement the things that they're negotiating, etc. Then you've got another concentric circle, which is sort of civil society and lobbyists and others who feel very strongly about what's being negotiated. And then you've got the media in like a fourth concentric circle trying to report on it and often casting light on what's going on because it's very difficult to know. So it is, it's tense. In the United Nations, every country has one vote. So you can have a country as small as the Marshall Islands with 100,000 people up against the United States or China. And that's why I think for the world, it's so important that it takes place in that venue, because there's no success for one part of the world unless the other part of the world is succeeding as well. There's no, it's like a boat, you know, one end of the boat can't go up, you know, the whole boat has got to rise. Mm. So that's a very important part of the dynamic.
And we've been hearing this morning about, well, how we should listen to other people's perspectives. But we're talking about world leaders here who have a lot at stake. So how much do emotions and feelings and taking that pause, how do they come into that?
So it becomes extremely tense at the end of the sort of a 2-week negotiation where nothing is agreed until everything's agreed. And so some countries will want one paragraph, others will want another, but you've got to have everything agreed for everybody and then you land the deal. So it becomes extremely personally pressurized. But in the run-up to that, you've got creating all the work that creates the conditions for success to be more likely. So the role of the presidency, the country that's hosting the negotiations, the role of the senior UN officials. And then what we've seen, and I think this is listening to your other guests, where women have played a very important role, is the agreement that, you know, amongst very important and senior women in different parts of the puzzle, that there's more that unites us than divides us. And so we want an outcome and that we can help create the conditions for success.
And there are now, I know, more women representatives now than when you started. How important is the role of women negotiators at COP?
Well, there's been consistent pressure for many years to A, have the issues of sort of how climate differentially impacts women and men in the negotiations. And Mary Robinson, the former president of Ireland, has really played a stalwart role in getting the issue on the agenda and then keeping it there. And then there's been a huge effort to get more women into the negotiations. And, you know, I teach negotiations, so I'm pleased to see some of my students now sitting at the table negotiating. But then I think that you've had, you know, a group of women, in particularly in the run-up to the Paris Agreement, and then subsequently, who continue to keep lines of communication open, even if we maybe positionally don't agree with each other, because at the end of the day, we want the greatest impact and the strongest agreement. And so there is a sort of informal network, I think, of women that is very important. And also there is a solidarity, because it can get very intense and a woman can be negotiating and, you know, she's got to be smarter than the guy. She's got to know more. There's a sort of toxic masculinity can sort of break out every now and again. You're also alone very late at night in small groups. I mean, there's a whole sort of what you wear, etc. I mean, there's a whole set of things that you have to think about as a woman negotiating or as a woman trying to influence that perhaps men don't.
That may surprise a lot of people. You talk about toxic masculinity there. Tell us more about that. Is that present?
Yes, I think it's basically a reflection of what you can often find in society. So a young woman is negotiating and comments about her dress, comments about her looks. Is she heard? Is she listened to? That famous quote by Ruth Bader Ginsburg, that if a woman puts an idea forward, you know, and then the you know, a man will repeat it, then it's the, you know, often the reference is to the man's repetition rather to the original idea that came from a woman. You see all of these things play out in the negotiations just as you do in business negotiations or in politics or in parliaments around the world. And I think, you know, having a greater balance of perspective in the room and having a real mix of representation is really, really important. And this question about listening, I think, is key.
I mean, because it's quite surprising to hear when you think of COP negotiations, you think that everyone will be listened to. These are really important things you're talking about. So to hear from you that people are discussing what clothes women are wearing and they're not listening to them when they're at the table, that may shock a lot of people.
Yeah, I think, I had young women come up to me in Dubai, right, and say, you know, we have to build relationships between each other because it's really hard in there. You know, I might be the only woman, because the negotiations break down into small groups. And so if you've got a lot of delegations with not very many women on them, then you may find yourself sort of reasonably isolated, even though we're talking about climate in 2023. So, yes, I mean, I had the young women negotiators sort of coming and sort of looking for confidence building, for some reassurance and for some sort of, you know, tactics. So I think it does still go on. But that said, we have women playing key roles. The special envoy for climate for Germany, a woman. The the head of the EU negotiations, the Deputy Prime Minister of Spain, a woman. Women who have been steeped in climate politics and the science for decades, right? So they bring an authority and an authenticity to their role. The architects of the Paris Agreement, Laurence Toubiana for the French government, for the UN, Christiana Figueres, women. So there is this the sense that key women in key positions can actually come together, and they all know each other, they all respect each other, even if they don't agree with each other and everything. And I think that kind of solidarity is absolutely critical.
Women are present, as you say, and it's good to hear that they're coming together in solidarity, but it's also sad to hear that misogyny is still there. Do you think COP29 can be different? What do you hope for the future, and how can we possibly get there?
Well, until society shifts, I think, you know, the negotiations are a microcosm of that shift. But I think women understand viscerally that climate is about the well-being of children, the next generation. It is the well-being of the most vulnerable. We know that societies that understand the sort of social bonds that women provide within a community can be more resilient if we rely upon those bonds and make sure that those bonds don't get broken. So there is a narrative also that if we're going to make the world more resilient, then helping women be more resilient is a sensible way to actually get there. So women as agents, as negotiators, women as agents for change, and women as at the community level, at the national level, and international level, being an equal part of this process, I think is fundamental to the outcome, not just to the way that it gets negotiated.
Yeah. There are criticisms, of course, that COP negotiations don't achieve what they set out to do, that they're not committed to tackling climate change fast enough and big enough. What's your view?
Yeah, I mean, I think the pushback that you saw in Dubai was the sort of cry, the last cry of a dying swan, right? We're getting to the point now where it is impossible to imagine that a fossil-fueled world can get us to where we want to be. We have to wean ourselves off fossil fuels. And so therefore, all of the vested interests in fossil fuels worldwide, and then those countries that have a vested interest in continuing to produce those fossil fuels, and everybody who's, you know, has a vested interest in continuing to consume them, start fighting back, and the backlash is significant. And so it's not surprising that we see these kinds of really heart-wrenching down-to-the-wire negotiations, but that means that we're getting to the heart of the matter.
Thank you. Rachel Kite, thank you so much for joining us on Woman's Hour. It's been fantastic to have you on the show. And that brings us to the end of this special episode of Woman's Hour, all about women and negotiation. Retired Met Police negotiator Nikki Perfect has, of course, been with us throughout the programme. Nikki, I just wondered if you could pick just one thing that people need to know when they're communicating or negotiating. One thing for them to take away today, what would that be?
For me, it would be listening. So be more present in the conversation. And don't make it all about you and waiting for your turn in the conversation to tell everybody what your opinion is. Just hear what people are really saying.
Nikki Perfect, thank you so much for being with us throughout the special programme today. Well, thanks for listening. There's plenty more from Woman's Hour on BBC Sounds.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hey, I hear you think podcasts are all about true crime, huh? Well, wise guy, the iHeartRadio app's got all kinds of podcasts. We got stuff you should know and stuff they don't want you to know. We got Bobby Bones, Big Boy, and Lou Later. We got SpongeBob Binge Pants and Exotic Erotic Storytime. We got Doughboys, Two Dudes in a Kitchen, Green Eggs and Dan. Hey, we got ElfQuest. We got podcasts for everything on the iHeartRadio app for free. If you don't download that, well, that's not just a true crime, my friend. That's criminal.